Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Karen Elliott House, a former publisher of the Wall Street Journal as well as a senior vice president of Dow Jones & Company. She currently serves as an adjunct senior fellow at the Belfair Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. In her 32-year career as a journalist at the Wall Street Journal, she specialized in the Middle East and interviewed such newsmakers as Saddam Hussein, Shimon Peres, Benjamin Netanyahu, Saudi King Abdullah, Yasser Arafat, Hosni Mubarak, Margaret Thatcher, Vladimir Putin, and Richard Nixon, to name just a few. Karen's journalistic talents have earned her a Pulitzer Prize, two Overseas Press Club Awards for coverage of the Middle East and Islam, and the Edwin M. Hood Award for Excellence in Diplomatic Reporting for a series on Saudi Arabia in 1982. To put icing on top of this cake, Ms. House is also the author of a very well-received book on Saudi Arabia entitled On Saudi Arabia, Its People, Past, Religion, Fault Lines, and Future. As always, we will have links to this book and other interesting tidbits on our website and Facebook fan page. Please do visit us and tell a friend. Karen, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you.
Now, I have interviewed a number of very prestigious guests before, from historian Philip Jenkins to talk show host Michael Medved, and from Bill Donahue of the Catholic League to Dan Stiles, who is a cowboy rodeo preacher in Wyoming, and that's still one of my favorite interviews. But I have never had the pleasure of talking to a recipient of the Pulitzer Prize. That is so cool, and it leads me to the most obvious question. Do you own a golden retriever dog?
I'm afraid of dogs, so I do not own a dog.
Oh, you're afraid of dogs, but they're so loving.
My daughter loves dogs and had two in the house.
Well, I can now firmly say that even though you have a Pulitzer Prize, I have a golden retriever dog, and we will keep him away. We might hear him if we're lucky in the background barking every so often, but he's a pretty safe dog, so no worries there. Anyways, let's get down to business and talk about what I'm sure our listeners are interested in, which is your impressions of the Middle East, most notably Saudi Arabia. These impressions have been formed and probably changed over the span of your three-decade career in reporting. But before talking about that, I would like to know a little bit more about your background and what it is like to be a Western journalist examining the Islamic world. These kind of nuts and bolts questions always fascinate me. Now, you begin your book with a personal observation about growing up in a small Texas town in a rather theologically strict Church of Christ denomination. So first off, how does someone from a small town in Texas get to walk the hallowed halls of the Wall Street Journal? I mean, Thomas Piketty, he told us that the dream of social mobility in the U.S. has long been dead. What's up?
Yes, it was my route from Matador to Manhattan actually went through the University of Texas. So I went to journalism school at the University of Texas, and that's the first time I ever heard of the Wall Street Journal. Actually, they interviewed, and this was 1970 when I graduated, and they didn't hire women then. But they interviewed me, and a few years later, I moved to Washington for the Dallas Morning News, which was the job I took right out of college. And we were in the same National Press building with the Wall Street Journal, and I guess the Journal made a decision to hire women, and so they looked at my clips from this college interview, and, you know, I went in to interview with them, and they asked for new stuff, but at any rate, I got hired.
Well, hook 'em horns. There's the University of Texas for you, you know. How did you become interested in reporting on the Middle East? Again, you know, small town Texas, and now all of a sudden in the Arab world. Whoa, what's going on here?
Again, I didn't set out to do that. I my goal in life was to be a political reporter. That's what I told the Dallas Morning News when they hired me, and they hired me to cover education. That's what I told the Wall Street Journal when they hired me, and they hired me to cover regulatory agencies. After a few years at the Journal, 3 years, the diplomatic correspondent for the Journal moved to New York, and I still hadn't been offered one of the political jobs in the Bureau, either covering the White House or covering the Congress, and I got offered the job of diplomatic correspondent, and I thought, well, why not? You know, it's going to be more interesting than by that time I was covering energy and agriculture, so I took it, and then my first days on the job were right after Sadat went to Jerusalem in November of 1977. So the Middle East was the big diplomatic topic. And I quickly discovered that I found international politics vastly more interesting than American politics. So I stuck with it for another 30 years.
I can imagine, and again, the fortuitous nature of your career path here, you know, moving from one place to another, doors are open, you take those opportunities. You end up reporting about diplomacy in the Middle East. Did you have to learn Arabic at all?
No, I mean, I wish my high school was so small. I took my first foreign language as a student at the University of Texas, and I took German. And I cannot sing, and I do not have I do not have an ear for music or languages, but I do not speak Arabic. Okay. So I used, obviously, a lot of translators in doing the reporting for the book.
Now, you came back to mentioning your small high school, and that brings us back to your small town Texas upbringing, and you make a very fascinating observation the first few pages of your book on Saudi Arabia. You said that growing up in that United Church of Christ denomination in that small town gave you a bit of insight into what you would experience in your time reporting in the Middle East. How so?
Well, it wasn't the United Church of Christ. It was the Church of Christ, which is a very conservative church. No music, no musical instruments. You sing, but no musical instruments, no alcohol, no dancing. My own father was very strict, so we had no telephone, no TV, no alcohol, no dancing, no dice.
No Wall Street Journal either.
So, and no Wall Street Journal. Yeah. We read the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. What was like Saudi Arabia was that, you know, basically everyone in Matador, all 900 people, church was the primary social gathering or entertainment. Everyone went to one of four Protestant churches. We got a Catholic church in town, a fifth church, when I was in the fifth grade, and it was actually in a house behind our house. So my brother and sister and I took my father's binoculars and watched out the bathroom window the whole Sunday that they inaugurated the Catholic Church in Matador, because we'd never seen an archbishop, you know, we'd never seen anything to do with a Catholic Church, so it was highly interesting. But the point is that I think I did not find in Saudi Arabia the idea of people taking religion seriously. It was something I understood. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't odd or different to me. And having a society in which fathers were the head of the household, and the women, we were not abused in any way, but, you know, we were obedient. That's just the way it was. So that's the way Saudi Arabia is, too. So that was not, it was not as foreign to me as it would be to a lot of other people.
And that's very interesting. We've had a number of other journalists on the program before, and they've always noted that there tends to be a bubble that certain people self-select into this bubble from their own raising and background, and a lot of them don't really understand religious folk. And so it's very strange. I mean, have you found that as well in your career, that there, you know, other people, you know, walking in the circles that you walk just don't get that religious thing?
Yeah, I don't think, you know, most of the people that one runs into these days, you know, are not people that that are comfortable at all discussing religion. And I'm totally comfortable discussing religion, and it's a key thing you have to discuss in Saudi Arabia. And I have read the Quran front to back now 3 times. I'm constantly studying. I find everything about Saudi Arabia extremely interesting because it is so different from this country.
Well, let's move into that. And you'd mentioned that you started your diplomatic reporting in 1977, and this is a very interesting and turbulent time. The Middle East didn't really register on our radar in the 1950s or 60s, but in the 1970s, with an increase in PLO terrorist attacks combined with the first two oil shocks and then the earth-moving Iranian Revolution, and the U.S. embassy hostage crisis for the United States, this region all of a sudden moves up to the front burner here. And so you're inserting yourself really at this point in time where everything is changing quite a bit. Did you sense that something fundamentally important and long-lasting was occurring in this region in 1977, 78, when you're starting your career reporting there?
Well, in 1977-78, you know, the U.S. was still a major factor in the Middle East. Henry Kissinger had done those disengagement negotiations after the 73 war, and we had been through the embargo, as you point out, and we'd had a lot of dealings with the Saudis. But the U.S. were, you know, the U.S. basically, it didn't just snap its fingers and say, do this and do that, and everybody hopped. But we were genuinely influential, and Carter had done the Camp David peace agreement in 1978. I covered that, so it was after I began my going to the Middle East. And it was fundamentally a region with authoritarian dictators, with the exception of the Israeli democracy. So it was, in that sense, stable. You know, what has happened over the last 20 years, basically, from the Iraq-Iran war in 1984 to 88, and the Gulf War and the American invasion of Iraq, et cetera, is that all those, the pillars of authoritarianism have come loose, and there's not much that has, nothing solid has replaced it.
Did you sense that might be coming back then, or was it just nobody knew what was the world to come?
I can't claim I sensed it, but I don't think anyone else did. I mean, I don't think anybody expected the Arab Spring in 2010-11 there. I mean, it was clear that what happened in Iran was a big shift, and it was clear that the Iranians sought to export that revolution all over the Middle East, and it was clear that it took a bit of hold in Saudi Arabia in the 90s after the Gulf War, because there were all these objections to the American military presence there, and there was the attack on the Grand Mosque in Mecca in 1979 by radical religious fundamentalists. But in terms of you know, seeing the kind of upheavals that have occurred in the last 3 or 4 years. I think that was surprising to everybody, frankly.
Yeah.
At least no one predicted it to me, and I was talking to all the alleged experts in this field throughout that period of time.
It is remarkable how much experts do not know.
Yeah, I remember very distinctly when the wall came down in 89, there were two people that, one person that directly predicted that, a Columbia professor, Sviarn Bialar, a Polish guy who had survived the Polish ghetto, and in a year before that, I was at some gathering of experts on the Soviet Union, and he said, within a year's time, within a few years' time, the Soviet Union won't exist. And literally a year later, the wall came down, and I guess within, 2 years of that, the Soviet Union didn't exist. And then also in 1988, I spent a whole year going around the world talking to people about whether the world, you know, is the U.S. a washed-up power? This was at a time when everyone thought Japan was number one. And Valerie Giscard d'Estaing, the former French president, said to me, in my lifetime, Poland will be in the EU. I thought that was about the most amazingly idiotic remark I'd ever heard anybody make. So I didn't quote him on it in my series to save him the embarrassment of it. But he proved to be proved to be right. So there were two people in my personal recollection that that did forecast big changes in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. But in my recollection, no one that I talked to was saying. There was a lot of work done saying the Middle East is a mess. There's a huge youth bulge coming, and this could provide change. But no one said that. I have no recollection of anyone predicting anything like, you know, what has happened in the last 3 years.
Yeah, experts do know a lot, but they also do not know a lot. In fact, they know less than they think
absolutely.
They do. And this is one of the reasons I love talking to people on the ground who are making just everyday observations about life. And journalists are, set into that environment. And when you set yourself into this environment in 1977, you're a fairly young reporter, and you're also female in a culture that tends to be male-dominated. A very turbulent time. Did you have any fear or concern about your own personal safety doing your reporting out there?
No, I have never been afraid. I mean, one time in the 80s in Damascus, walking around at night, being led by somebody I barely knew to go see a PLO official that was supposed to be in Damascus, I thought to myself, I could disappear and no one would have any idea what happened to me. This isn't too smart. But, you know, that's the closest I've ever come to being afraid. I mean, people ask me that all the time about going to Saudi Arabia. Aren't you afraid? And I say with absolute honesty, the only thing that frightens me in Saudi Arabia is being in traffic, being in a car. I mean, the more people die in Saudi Arabia per capita, I think, in car accidents than virtually any other country. They just don't. They have a kind of view that when it's your time, God will take you, and so why stop at a red light? You know.
Wow. Yeah.
So the driving is not good, but other than that, I have not been frightened.
Well, that is really fascinating. And at the beginning of your book as well, you make a very interesting claim, and I found this to be utterly fascinating. You said that being Western and female gave you some very unique advantages in reporting in Saudi Arabia. Explain that.
Saudis, women and men are segregated in Saudi Arabia, so for a man like you to go around and go into people's houses and sit down and talk to the women is not not something you can do, certainly not in traditional houses. There are westernized Saudis who would sit down and the women would sit down and talk to you, no problem. But if you really want to look at the real Saudi Arabia, those kinds of people wouldn't be sitting down with you. And so a woman can go see women, but men are also prepared, almost all men. There are some deeply religious conservatives who don't want to talk to a strange woman. But most men, even traditionalists, are willing to talk to a woman. So you can deal with both sides of the fence. And people there, if they agree to see you, they show you respect. That's kind of part of the culture, that you are obliged to be respectful to those you let into your home or earlier into your tent. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's not a, you don't have to ever worry that somebody's going to do anything untoward when you go to visit them.
Yeah, that is one of those very fascinating things that you get to, you know, talk to the women as well as the men, and you get to see things that a lot of male reporters don't, and stuff
yeah,
at the ground level.
With a very conservative religious family, with the woman, the husband, obviously, he was very conservative and religious too, and he picked us up one night, but I was never introduced to him, and I had to be completely covered, face, head, everything, to be on the street in that family's car. Mm-hmm. But the first wife lived downstairs, she lived upstairs, and when the husband came every other day to her house, I had to go into my room and stay out of sight until, you know, he left again, or until she exited where he was and she would come and talk to me. But it was really interesting to see that family up close, because they had a TV, but she did not want her sons seeing women with bare faces. Mm-hmm. And Saudi television, the network, Saudi network, now does have females who cover their heads but not their faces to read the news. So she had only the religious channel because she does not want any uncovered female faces in her home. I was never obviously introduced to the sons either. You would hear them going out at 4 o'clock in the morning with their father to pray and coming back in. But I mean, it's just very strange to literally be living in a house with men and you never see them or meet them because you're not related to them, and therefore they can't mix with you.
In that kind of culture that is very male-dominated, you have the opportunity to talk with women. How open do you think women were when they were talking with you? Was there a sense that there was some self-censorship going on, or did you find them to be very open about the different things you talked about? And what did you talk about?
Well, I tried to talk to everybody about as broad a range of subjects as I could. I started out the whole reporting trying at first to get around the entire country. Even though 80% of the population lives in three cities, you wouldn't try to write about American culture and politics and life by going to New York, Washington, and L.A. So I got out all over the country. And when you go to see people, you know, the more westernized women are happy to talk about their lives, and they criticize the constraints they're under, some of them freely, some of them probably would like to be more open than they are. I mean, it's hard to judge what people don't tell you. The conservative women, like this lady, and I met an imam's mother and wife and six sisters, and, you know, they are very proud of their lifestyle. I asked the daughters of this, one of the daughters of this woman, the religious lady, how do you think your life will be different from your mother's? And she said, my mother is doing everything possible to give me a life exactly like hers. Now, if my daughter, my daughter would be horrified at the thought of me trying to give her a life exactly like I had. I mean, she's always saying, we're not in the dark ages anymore. But I tried to talk to people about change. What's changed in your lifetime? What would you like to see change? How is your life different from your mother's? How would you like your life to be different? As a way to get a conversation going. And then, you know, just a lot of stuff comes out. I tried to talk to her about, you know, views on abortion. What's it like to have your husband have another wife? Do you actually know her? Do you go see her? I mean, she was willing to, talk about all of those things. And with this other group of ladies, the imam's mother and sisters, et cetera, their mother was one of three wives of their father. And so I asked the six sisters, do any of you, your husbands, have another wife? And they all said no. And then one of them said, but it wouldn't be up to us if he, you know, if he takes another wife, that's the way it is. It's not something somebody in this country would so casually say, yeah, if my husband decides to take another wife, it's up to him. There are many things that are very different, but people are very invested in the lifestyle they live, whether it's a very conservative one or the more westernized working women who want to drive and, you know, want more freedom. They're happy to discuss it in both camps because they believe, you know, passionately in these two divergent lifestyles and everything in between.
That is a very interesting observation because from our Western vantage point, we oftentimes look at these veiled women and say, oh, they must be oppressed and it's all false consciousness. And if they only knew that they could watch many more television shows, everything would be liberating for them. And their views must not be very sincere, but that's not what you're necessarily finding, is it?
No, and they're not uneducated. This lady is went to King Saud University. This is another thing that always make Americans or a lot of Westerners think, well, they must just be uneducated or they wouldn't think like that.
Mm-hmm.
They're not, some of them are uneducated, but many of them are not. And, they have an education and they still believe deeply in the need to be segregated as men and women, that, you know, your husband has a right to have a wife if he wants. And I just went to see this religious lady. I was in Saudi Arabia 2 weeks ago. I went back to see her. And her son has gone to Syria to fight, which is illegal. The government forbids that, but he flew off, so he won't be able to come back. And the father was so angry, he blamed the mother. And he was so angry, he got himself a third wife. This lady is just coping with all of this, and it's her view is this is all God's will and, you know, everything that happens, and she simply has to, you know, bear up under it all.
Mm-hmm. You definitely
no anger. No, I mean, she's really quite amazing. I was impressed because she is a true believer. There are a lot of Saudis who are doing the ritual prayer, but are doing all kinds of other things. You know, it's always impressive, I think, to see people who practice what they preach. And she tried over and over, including this last time, to convert me. So we wind up having big religious discussions on, you know, her view, of course, is that Jesus is not the Son of God, and this will send you to hell believing that, and she wants to save me from that.
Mm-hmm. You do certainly have a very unique and interesting perspective on all this, just being able to talk to these individuals, your own background, as we mentioned before. And so I want to start now probing what you have seen and your thoughts about Saudi Arabia based upon your book and your recent op-ed piece that you penned for the Wall Street Journal, and we'll link back to that. And you are starting to see some changes that are occurring as a result of the Arab Spring. These are absolutely fascinating. Our listeners are going to be very interested in that. But first, give us a general view of the Saudi landscape. And in reading your book, I learned a great deal. The picture you paint in your book is quite different than what I think the typical American, including myself, you know, thinks about the country. I mean, I think Saudi Arabia, I think that's a sparse population floating on a sea of oil, and Mercedes Benzes and gold coins just rain from the sky. But socioeconomically speaking, that's not quite it. What does Saudi Arabia really look like?
Yeah, there is real poverty in Saudi Arabia, and there's obviously wealth like I have never seen anywhere else in the world. And I've been in the Philippines, you know, Hong Kong, lots of parts of the world where they're very wealthy people. But wealth in Saudi Arabia is on a par with nothing I've ever seen anywhere else. But there's also enormous poverty. As I say in the book, 40% of the population lives on less than $1,000 a month. And I visited, that was the hardest thing actually, getting into the homes of poor people, because others would promise, you can't just knock on the door, others would promise to take me, and then they'd call back and say, no, we can't do it, they don't want to see you. And I finally, you know, did succeed in seeing some very poor people. And, you know, I described in the book, a lady with three children, and they all four sleep in one bed, and her husband was in prison for selling drugs, and she had told the children that he was away on a business trip, so she has to take what little money she earns, buy a phone card, and take it to the prison to him so he can phone his children, as if he's phoning them from a business trip. She worked hard, like, to give her kids a better education, et cetera. But the education is poor. It's not, they have a lot of money, but not a lot of well-organized leadership. So the country has a lot of needs, and the population knows it. 60% of the population is under 20 years of age.
Wow.
That's a staggering statistic. And it means that there is this huge youth bulge, and these young people don't want to go through the old methods that what the Saudis call their desert democracy, where the king has a, quote, majlis, which is a big meeting, and anybody can come, and they go in and they present their little petition. My cousin stole my donkey, my cousin stole my land, you know, whatever their complaint is. And they're supposed to, the king's supposed to look into it, he and his team, and satisfy, fix things up somehow. They think that's demeaning. They don't want to go through this kind of approach the sovereign, or approach another prince who's a governor of your province or whatever. So they are having to change some of their ways, and as I wrote in that piece in the journal, they now have a website where you can file a complaint against the government, they are trying to create, they're not trying to do any political reform. They don't intend to have anyone have anything to say about who runs the country. That's the royal family's business. But they are trying to increase the ways in which people can give them feedback. And what I heard most from people over the 5 years of intensely reporting that book is that they're not asking to, some of them are, but the majority are not asking to throw out the royal family. They're asking for what would really be very simple: more transparency in the way the money is spent, more accountability in the way the money is spent, and more equity. Because they don't view the money as belonging to the royal family. They view it as belonging to the population. And so Saudis, these young people, not illogically say, I want more of it. Why can't I live like someone in Dubai or Qatar?
Mm-hmm.
But the Saudis have a population of nearly 20 million people, 20 million Saudis. And, you know, the population of Qatar and Dubai is in the few hundred thousand.
Mm-hmm.
So it is, the country has got, I think, three big problems confronting it. They have tried to buy peace by paying more money to people to buy their acquiescence. So more money to the religious, more money to the military establishment, which is really an employment program. It's a way of keeping a lot of men employed. And when that oil money begins to decline, as it inevitably will, they're going to have a hard time. The other is the succession. They have got to go from a generation of old men that has run the country since their father died in 1953. The father had 36 sons, and these sons have been succeeding him as king, and they are now about to reach the last son, who is 68 years old, and they're going to have to pick the son of one of the sons, and that's going to cause the family, I think, some real difficulty, because every brother feels his son should be the king. So succession, in the fact that for the next 5-10 years, as far as you can see, they're going to have a very elderly king. The current king is 90, and the crown prince is 78, and this younger crown prince in waiting is 68, so, you know, mm-hmm. they're not going to have a very youthful and energetic leader for quite a while.
I want to come back to the succession crisis in a minute here, but you mentioned this very young population that is growing, and it's combined with the Saud family that is largely running the country politically, but also economically. One of the more fascinating things that I found in your book was this issue of social mobility, that a lot of young people are chafing under the fact that there's a fairly significant glass ceiling. If you're working in a business, you're a mid-level manager, and you're doing really well, but you're not a member of the Saud family, so you're only going to go so far. And this really creates an interesting cultural climate. Discuss that a little bit.
Well, the Saudis, by and large, work only for the government. So the military, the interior ministry, teaching, some government job. 90% of the employees in the private sector are foreigners.
Hmm.
So Saudis like the shorter working hours, the greater security of government employment, but the government can't employ all of them now. They have got to, as this population bulge comes, they've got to find a way to get them into the private sector. But there's no particular, there's not much incentive, and I found, at least in much of the Saudi population, which, if you think about it, is make sense. I mean, you can't aspire, obviously, to be here. Every kid can say, I could be president, mm-hmm. I could be governor, I could be a senator, I could be a CEO. There, the country has 13 provinces or states. Each of those has a governor, or 12 of the 13 has a governor who's a prince, and a deputy governor who's a prince. And the key ministries are controlled by princes: defense, foreign affairs, interior. And obviously the king is a former prince. So the royal family controls more, and not only the major political jobs, but they have increasingly also gotten into business. So it's like, I use an analogy in the book, if you work for a company and the CEO and the board of trustees and board of directors and all the regional vice presidents even are members of a family, and you're not a member of that family, you can't aspire even to be a regional vice president. So why would you come to work every day motivated and, you know, trying to move mountains? You don't. You come to work waiting to get your paycheck and go home. And I think that is a systemic problem that they can't do a lot about until they're willing to do something about the royal family itself. Mm.
You mentioned that this also leads to a culture of, you know, corruption or skimming as well. You know, I'm not going anywhere, and I'm not getting paid all that well, so I'll just kind of skim for my, you know, account here at work that I have to go on business trips and things. Is that what's happening as well?
Yeah, people, you know, feel like increasingly, I think, the royal family is getting all of these things. So whatever I can take, there's no reason not to do it.
Yeah.
And there's also, you know, no shame in the culture of asking for things. So rich businessmen, too, get asked all the time by people, could you send my son to college? Could you, you know, and this is something that critical Saudis then say, you know, we've become a nation of beggars, that we are taught, go to the king, go to your local prince and ask for something. If you're hungry, you can go to a prince's home and ask for a meal. You know, so it's, and you can ask for bigger things. So it's just instead of the whole idea of learning to take care of yourself and be responsible for yourself, is not, the cultures are so different. Our culture starts with the individual and with this idea that I can do anything I want to do. I can be anything I want to be. Their whole culture starts with the community of believers. We're all in this together. You know, I'm not responsible for what I do. The whole community, we're trying. You know, so I quote a Saudi in the book talking about, you know, you're not, your family controls you, and your family is controlled by the tribe, and the tribe by the religious, and the religious by the royal family. It's like those stacks of Russian dolls, you know, mm-hmm. where one comes inside the other.
Yeah.
You know, those little wooden thing, you open them
right
up, and inside each doll is a smaller doll, and that's the way the system works there. The individual is just the tiny little nut inside his family, inside his tribe, inside the religious domination, inside the royal family domination. So you just don't take responsibility or initiative. I mean, there are clearly exceptions to this, but by and large, you know, Saudis are happy to just go to their government job. Nobody wants you to do anything or take any initiative because it would rock the boat. And fitna, as they call it, or chaos, is the worst thing that can happen in society. You are expected to support your leaders, even if they're even if they got there by improper means, because to have chaos, like what's happening in Syria now, to have that kind of chaos is considered wrong in God's eyes. When God wants you to have a better leader, he'll give you one. So you're just supposed to obey, and obey is what you're taught in your family, in your tribe, in your mosque, you know, by your rulers.
One of the interesting things that struck me in reading your book, and you mentioned that 90% of those employed in the private sector are foreigners. I'm just curious, with these economic problems, this younger culture feeling like they're hitting a glass ceiling, and why not open up the private sector to Saudi citizens themselves?
They are doing that. That was one of the big pushes of the last year. But the fact is, Saudis don't want to work in the private sector because you can lose your job, and they are not, by and large, as I said in the book, qualified for the jobs they're willing to take, and they won't take the jobs that they're qualified for. So, but the government did, because of the high unemployment among young people. The first thing it did, I think wisely, King Abdullah for the last 5 years has been providing scholarships abroad, not only to men, but to Saudi women. So there are 180,000 Saudis studying outside of the kingdom. And those are just beginning to go back, and that's going to be one of their issues. Do those young people find jobs that they feel are worthy of their new education in the U.S. or Britain or wherever they went? But they began a little over a year ago to try to, for both unemployment reasons and security reasons, to get foreigners properly registered or out of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And because foreigners, by and large, are willing to work for a lot less than a Saudi, because the foreigners of choice now are basically Pakistanis, Bangladeshis, Indians, Muslims from those three countries. They're countries, and the Philippines, they're countries with a lot of poverty, so people are happy to have a job. They come and work as a doorman in a hotel, the security guard at, you know, the prince's house or the hotel or wherever. Most of these are menial jobs. There are obviously some white-collar jobs, too, that are held by foreigners. Those Indians, Pakistanis, Bangladeshis, Americans, Brits, others. But they have they tried to kick a lot of people out of the country. They did. They are trying to force businesses to hire Saudis, because you can't get visas anymore to bring in a foreigner unless you get so many points, your company. And the way you get points is by hiring Saudis. And they have tried to push the hiring of females, and females get you more points than males. So it's very interesting. It's an incentive system. If you hire a female or a handicapped person, you get more points than if you hire a Saudi male. So that's one of the things I spent time on in this last trip. There are more Saudis getting jobs, as I said in that piece in the Wall Street Journal, and a lot more women. So, and they have gotten most of the foreigners in the country. They now know who they are. They have them properly registered, because they're increasingly nervous with all of the horrible things going on around them, of, you know, the risk of terrorism in their own country from people that they don't even know are in the country. because it's easy to sneak across the border from Yemen. So you now have to get fingerprinted. I had to get fingerprinted to enter the country with my passport. So if anyone should steal my passport and try to enter, you know, the fingerprint wouldn't match. They are fingerprinting all Saudis now, too.
Hmm.
Not forcibly, but you can't get your documents renewed now without, you know, having your, without getting fingerprinted. So slowly they're getting a real grip on who's inside the country. But I think, as I say, for both reasons, security reasons and unemployment, youth unemployment, they tried to weed out some of the foreigners, but there's still the number hasn't dropped dramatically from the 90% still.
Now, one of the things that you mentioned a little bit earlier, you mentioned religious domination by the royal family. They're usually affiliated with this brand of Islam,
Wahhabis.
Mm-hmm. And how much is that creating tensions within Saudi Arabia now? I mean, the whole religious environment is very much in flux in the Middle East nowadays, and Westerners tend to see Islam as being very monolithic, but in reality, it's not. It's very fissiparious, and it's a lot of changes could be occurring here. What's happening with Saudi Arabia religiously?
The religious establishment, the people who issue the fatwas or rulings on what does the Quran require of you. There is a council of senior ulama of 21 people. Those individuals are supposed to be the most learned scholars of the Quran and the Sunnah and Hadith, the stories and sayings of the Prophet. They are appointed by the king and can be removed by the king. So they tend to be fairly supportive of what the royal family wants. And this has eroded their reputation in the kingdom, because in 1990, when king wanted to bring in American troops to help defend Saudi Arabia in case Saddam went from Kuwait into Saudi Arabia, he asked the religious for a fatwa that said that this is okay under Islam, because the traditional view had been that it is wrong to, you know, have infidels in the kingdom. And certainly, I mean, everybody knows there are foreigners there, but in the proportion of 500,000 troops. The religious did issue that fatwa saying it's proper, and that very much, that's one of the things Saudi cite as eroding their credibility. So I think the religious establishment has become more, in the eyes of the people, a supporter of the royal family, and not necessarily, as it used to be, the legitimizer of the royal family, because they provided the good housekeeping seal of approval on the religiosity of the royal family. But now people don't all see the religious establishment as being sufficiently devoted to their Wahhabi moorings, that they are too happy to do what King Abdullah wants, not what Allah wants.
I want to close off here with the few minutes that we have left and talk about the changes that are on the horizon. And this is what you were talking about recently in your Wall Street Journal op-ed piece, and we will link back to that for listeners who are interested in doing this. I should note that we are talking on July 2nd, 2014. So anything we say about the future, it's understanding that nobody predicted the Berlin Wall falling. Things can happen very quickly and we can't predict things. But we've already talked about several of the tensions here. You have a growing young population. You have an aging Saudi family, and this issue of succession looms very large, combined with these other socioeconomic problems and trends that we've been seeing. What does the future hold for Saudi Arabia, especially in the midst of the turmoil that seems to be surrounding it to the north in Iraq and Syria and in many other parts of the Arab and Islamic world?
In the short run, as what I found on this trip to Saudi Arabia, is that Saudis seem to be giving their rulers a pass on political reform, because they are saying, at least we're not like Syria or Egypt or Iraq. We are secure in our homes. We can go out on the street. So, yes, we'd like more transparency by the government, more accountability, more sharing, more economic reform, more equity, more rule of law. But at least we're not killing each other. I think that will last for a bit. But over time, as depending on what happens in Iraq and Syria, if the ISIS or ISIL, as some say, manages to make a more appealing, quote, Islamic state or caliphate, a lot of the religious Saudis are going to say, this is, you know, we should be more holy like these people, and that whole group will attempt to infiltrate and stir up trouble in Saudi Arabia, and the Iranians also are going to have, if the ISIL continues to keep parts of Iraq and Syria, you know, the Iranians' influence in that part of the world continues to grow. And that's a problem for the Saudis. So I think that it's going to become harder and harder for Saudi Arabia to remain an island of stability in a sea of turmoil.
Let me ask this in closing then. Given what you just said about the difficulty in remaining a stable country in a sea of turmoil, is there any basis for optimism in the direction that Saudi Arabia or the general region is heading, or are we facing some very dark clouds out here on the horizon?
Well, I think the fact that the Saudi government seems to have concluded that moderation is a more moderate Islam is in its own interest, and I do think they have made that conclusion. They are trying to control their religious. They didn't for 30 years. They encouraged just the opposite, but they, since basically 2005 or 6, when the terrorists began bombing inside Saudi Arabia, the royal family has tried to propound a more moderate Islam. If it could help do that in the region as a whole, which is majority Sunni, as are the Saudis, if they could legitimize a more moderate Islam and not this jihad infidels, we've got to kill everybody Islam that seems to be gaining, that could have a significant impact. And if we in the U.S. would actually encourage the Saudis to do that and support them. But, you know, right now the administration doesn't want anything to do with anything in the Middle East. So, and the Saudis, I don't think they need support and hand-holding to have the courage to stand up and do these things. So, to me, the only positive sign out there is that the Saudis themselves, I think, have decided that more moderate Islam, the royal family has, is in its own survival interest.
Something that we'll have to watch over the coming years. My guest today has been Karen Elliott House. Karen, thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.